Many moons ago, when the world was young and heroes walked the earth, there was born the History Podcast. And in this world, there was the Beeb. There was Lars Brownworth and a bloke called Mike Duncan, and we heard Mike and knew he was good. And so was spawned a new generation, wherein I was inspired by Robin Pearson, who picked up the mantle of the Roman Empire in Byzantium. Robin, I'm glad to say, is still going strong, is still producing magnificent history and entertainment, and here is a message from him.
Hello everyone, this is Robin Pearson from the History of Byzantium podcast. It seems like you enjoy your history recounted to you by an erudite, funny Englishman. Well, I am also an Englishman. And if you like a bit of Roman history, then come join me for a thousand-year epic of incredible highs and devastating lows. Check out the History of Byzantium wherever you get your podcasts, or go to thehistoryofbyzantium.com. For now, back to David.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello everyone and welcome to the History of England, episode 402, Enemies of the State. Last time, we talked about Charles's attitude to negotiation and we saw the Scots off home. We talked about the plan of the Presbyterians to ensure the victory of their vision of a future England. The hat, that was Denzil Hollis's plan then, had three corners had his hat. First corner. Remove the Scots and gain control of the king. Second, disband the new model army. This would achieve two objectives. It would remove an unbearable financial burden from the soldiers of the people. It would also remove the greatest concentration of those described in Edward's Gangrena as dangerous sectarians, oppressors and social subversives, the people known as independents. And then the third corner of the hat. Agree a deal with the defeated and surely utterly contrite king that embedded Presbyterianism within the ancient constitution, thus completing the dismantling of both Laudianism and independency. A haberdasher's dream. And the status report at the start of 1647? Well, pretty good. Pats on the back all round. The abolition of the episcopacy had been achieved, tickety-tito. It had provided the funds to pay the Scots what they were owed, and then it had delivered Charles into English hands. Now for stage two. Destroy the new model army. In this episode then, let us start with a bit of scene setting. So the king is sitting at Newcastle railway station without a ticket to his destination, suitcase and guitar in hand. So let us see him homeward bound and settled in all nice. And then I think you and I should have a chat about the object of this coming campaign, the new model army and their leadership. Then we can get on with what Ian Gentles has termed the counter-revolution, the attempt to break them with a rod of iron, like a potter's vessel, and all that sort of thing. So, how does that sound? Okay, Alice Clarke, sitting comfortably, then let us begin. Charles was picked up from the station and thoroughly enjoyed his journey south. It was just like being a real king all over again. People lined the streets to cheer him onwards. He was allowed to stop from time to time, and onlookers crowded forward. He was given permission to use his magical powers and touch scrofula sufferers for the king's evil. And there is nothing more kingly, let me tell you, than touching for the king's evil. Make you look really good, just like God's anointed. Charles's son loved it to pieces too. He touched about 90,000 people. You should try it. Well, maybe not, actually. Anyway, General Fairfax then greeted him at Nottingham, and he was very gracious, not brutish at all. And eventually they came to a very grand house, Holdenby House, in Northamptonshire. This was to be his resting place, while the minor details were finalised on the Newcastle propositions, as they surely would be. Although it has to be said, Northampton has a disappointingly poor rugby team, of course, for which reason Leicester would have been much better, so much more tigerish. But whatever. Northamptonshire is in striking distance of London without being too close, because no sensible parliamentarian wanted the king in London. Who knows what the crowds might do if they could see him? Charles was very comfortable at Holdenby. He was given every creature comfort. Well, except one rather important creature comfort. He wasn't given spiritual comforts, or at least not the type he liked. He was again firmly denied his beloved Book of Common Prayer and Anglican chaplains. However, the Spencers were just next door at Althorp, so he went there to chat, to be fawned on, to play bowls, which also turns out he found very addictive and played a lot of. Now, the Spencer Earl of Sunderland had died in the king's cause at the First Battle of Newbury, and so his son was still just a nipper, and I assume, therefore, he was entertained by the lady of the house, Dorothy Spencer. Now, her brother was a famous parliamentarian and political theorist, Algernon Sidney, quite a character, writer and philosopher, who would write that, "As death is the greatest evil that can befall a person, monarchy is the worst evil that can befall a nation," which is topical. He would finally be executed in 1683, and instead of just mouthing pieties as he went, he gave something of a lecture, remarking that we live in an age that makes truth pass for treason. Good point, Algernon. He finally declared he was dying for the good old cause, and then lost his head. Anyway, enough digressing. We'll leave Charles there, at Holdenby, noodling away, and turn to our next scene setter. Let us talk about the new model army and its vibe. I'd also like to talk a little bit about the senior commanders. First thing to say is that the new model never meant to go to sea. They never meant to become political. Most of what I'm going to say, by the way, comes from Ian Gentle's definitive book, The New Model Army, Agents of Revolution. He wrote that all the way through, their first priority was always religious, the eradication of ungodliness. Liberty of the subject and privilege of Parliament were also important to them, but they only get the silver and bronze medal. Another thing to remember is that they were very, very proud of what they had done and why. There will be a quote later where they declare themselves to be no mercenary army, because they were volunteers, called by Parliament to fight for the liberties of the people. They had risked their blood for the cause, and they expected to be treated accordingly. Okay, firstly then, this was a godly army. There were several chaplains who travelled with the army. There was frequent preaching and sermons attracted vast numbers. There were frequent prayer and fasting sessions. Scripture study was promoted, and this permeated all levels of the army. Their beloved commander-in-chief exemplified it very well. Thomas Fairfax always liked to consult religious men before embarking on a course of action. He appointed Hugh Peter as chief chaplain to the army, and he gave him great latitude. Philip Skippon, as Major General of the Infantry, published three books of devotion dedicated to his fellow soldiers. Cromwell, as Lieutenant General of Horse, was famously the same. The night before the assault on Basing House, just as one example, he spent most of the night praying and reading scripture. Their officers were equally religious, and most of the rank and file too, although they were a bit more of a mixed bag. Lay preaching was widespread by both officers and soldiers, and Parliament really didn't like this. A bunch of uneducated amateurs preaching, and on their orders, Fairfax tried to crack down on it, but it was unstoppable, and the new model was completely unapologetic about it. Colonel William Gough, one of the regicides, incidentally, wrote eloquently of the right of the humblest soldier to act as a channel for divine retribution. Lay preaching was more important in many other ways, too. In the building of the enormously vital and powerful esprit de corps and unity of the new model, which they held very dear. And it also unavoidably embedded the idea of liberty of conscience. The sense of spiritual egalitarianism was also part of a wider tradition of equality. This reached from small things like Fairfax's rule of giving each foot regiment a turn at marching at the head of the column, to bigger things like the willingness of officers to share every risk in battle with their men, and to really quite remarkable things like the General Council of the Army. You'll hear about this in a while, but in 1647, Fairfax creates a General Council of the Army, and each regiment elected agents, or agitators as they were called, who sat on the council with an equal footing in making policy. It is extraordinary. Another feature was the social makeup of the army. Following the self-denying ordinance, the social background of the officers was much closer to the rank and file than it had ever been before. They had a much closer shared experience that helped this sense of unity. Officers had a close sympathy and empathy for their men. Royalists were both disgusted at this social monstrosity and revelled in mocking them for it. The new model didn't greatly care. The strength of the esprit de corps, unity, respect for all ranks and shared values, had some consequences that did not make them popular. They felt themselves to be a little bit different from the rest of society, to stand just a bit slightly apart. Despite this, their behaviour towards local communities in terms of foregoing the normal tradition of plunder was exemplary, but the downside was the brutality of their iconoclasm. The stories of stabling horses in sacred places, destroying priceless works of art and stained glass, were legion. Wing and fonts was also something of a fave. If you haven't relieved yourself into holy water, then you weren't really trying properly. From the same stable came their suppression of alehouses, horse racing, even Morris dancing, for crying aloud. The Morris! People hated this. It did not make them popular. Another thing to remember in this general story of their cohesion is the respect in which Fairfax and Cromwell were held. It is a respect based partly on shared religious values, partly on shared acceptance of the risks of war in the front line, and partly on a sense that every man in the army was valued no matter what their social status. So, Richard Baxter, the Presbyterian minister, he was horrified when he marched with the army at the license allowed the soldiers. He gasped at the disrespectful jokes. They translate no better than Shakespearean comedy, it has to be said, but gags like calling Presbyterians priest-biters or divines dry-vines. But they offended Baxter. I mean, they're really not great gags, I have to admit, but scandalously witty back then, by all accounts. Worst of all, wrote Baxter, the military command took on them to join themselves to no party, but to be for the liberty of all. Which sounds rather nice to us now, but Baxter was appalled and set about trying to change it as quickly as he could. Neither Fairfax nor Cromwell, though, were pushovers. Both were strict disciplinarians given to upholding the Articles of War, and stories of soldiers punished when caught thieving from villages were very common. Military discipline was also strict. There's a story of Cromwell and Ireton being stopped by guards who refused to let them pass until they got the right password. Later, the guard confessed he'd known them all along, but felt sure Cromwell was checking up on them. Having said that, I think I've heard exactly the same story in about a billion military stories across time, space and cultures. So, you know, could be apocryphal. Despite the strict discipline, Cromwell was known as something of a fun lover. Yes, I know. But look, Puritans can be fun too. Baxter again wrote, he was naturally of such a vivacity, hilarity and alacrity as another man is when he had drink a cup of wine too much. Fairfax was admired not only for his energy and courage in battle, but his modesty and humility. His style was nothing like the grandiosity which Robin of Essex had carried out his command with, which Woolrich described as almost vice-regal pomp. Instead, as one contemporary remarked, Fairfax was a man thankful for respects, and yet casts away honour from himself. Both Fairfax and Cromwell were known to be incorruptible, both turned aside offers of bribes and conspiracies. When Charles meets them in Newmarket, for example, he distrusts both of them because, as he says to his courtier John Barclay, neither asked for a reward or favour. In return, it was true for Fairfax, as was written by a contemporary for Cromwell, that he loved his soldiers as his children, and his greatest care was to see them provided for with all necessities. I should get on. But one more thing briefly. Fairfax would find himself much more conflicted by the execution of the king, and from that point kind of rather fades into the background, and it's led to a historiography that Fairfax was little more than Cromwell's stooge, tricked and deceived by the more ambitious man, that Fairfax was not political and came to oppose the Commonwealth. The historian Andrew Hopper argues strongly against this. For example, as I believe we have covered, it was Fairfax that marshalled support in the Commons to pursue the Hothams. He notes that the pair of them shared many values, worked closely together, and that both the Fairfaxes were more secure in their social status than was Cromwell, which helped maintain the relationship of commander and lieutenant. That Cromwell never challenged Fairfax's authority, and if you believe his words, certainly respected his boss, such as he wrote to him in 1648. I put a high and true value on your love, which when I forget, I shall cease to be a grateful and an honest man. And Whitlock noted in his diary that in councils, although Fairfax said little, he frequently overruled Cromwell, and at the end of any discussion, he was the only judge. The picture, then, is of a leadership and an army with a strong sense of solidarity and purpose, not always popular, despised by royalists. The events of the next couple of years in particular will test this cohesion and solidarity to the very core. It is worth noting, as will come out, that neither Fairfax nor Cromwell wanted or expected to get into a battle with Parliament. Both worked hard initially to conciliate and carry out Parliament's commands, however they dislike them, but there will come a time when both will be forced to choose where their primary loyalty and sense of justice lay. So, for Hollis & Co, now was the time for corner two of the Hatch strategy. Destroy the new model.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
The departure of the Scots immediately weakened the position of the new model. It had been a necessity, but the last vestige of that necessity had now left, and there was really no need to keep them, except maybe a portion to fight in Ireland and finally end that five-year rebellion. And all what that was left then, as the sense of obligation and gratitude faded away in the hearts of the population, were the bad things. Memories of all the iconoclasm and smashing and burning, the economic disruption, the super high taxes and monthly assessment. Until this point in Parliament, many had continued to adhere to the independence because they favoured the active prosecution of the war, but now that need had gone, and many drifted back to their spiritual Presbyterian fellows, and the strength of the independents in Parliament waned. Hollis and the Derby House Committee seem to have lacked any sense of obligation to the men of the new model at all, as it happens, nor indeed to their wives and families who had had to cope throughout the wars. Instead, they quite openly presented them as a crippling burden on civilians and an obstacle to peace with the king. There is a deal of truth in the former. And it seems widely agreed by historians today that the coming crisis is a classic example of Hollis's predilection for self-foot annihilation with the use of a gun. The army had some concerns, which we'll come to, but if treated with respect, gratitude, and above all a modicum of justice and generosity, it seems perfectly clear that the new model army would have been disbanded without any shouting louder than the squeak of the cutest Fluffy's dormouse. There must therefore have been other agendas which led Hollis and the Presbyterian Party to the aggressive path they took. Money would, of course, certainly be one. And the all-powerful and Presbyterian-dominated London Common Council in particular was way behind in paying its assessments and deeply reluctant to play anything at all, let alone any more. But fear and hatred must be part of it. Fear of the social values of the new model, hatred of the prevalence of independency and the creed of religious toleration. So, Hollis and co. realised that the strength of the leadership of the new model was a key obstacle, so their first instinct was to make life easier for themselves by removing Fairfax from command and replacing him with a reliably compliant Presbyterian general. They thought Colonel Richard Graves would do the job nicely. They were helped in this by the fact that Cromwell was absent throughout February from the House of Parliament. Both he and Fairfax will struggle with health at key moments and be absent for weeks on end. This is just such one of those occasions. So when the proposal to replace Fairfax with Graves was put to the vote in Parliament, it was very close. 147 MPs voted to fire him, 159 voted against. A margin of 12 seems scant reward for the general who'd brought the war so swiftly to an end. Hollis continued the attack. On the 18th of February 1647, the Commons voted that the size of the army would be slashed from over 20,000 in the new model alone to a bijou 5,400 horse and 1,000 dragoons. The infantry would either agree to go and fight in Ireland or be demobbed. The scale of it was extraordinary and a little bit wild. And nothing was said about pay in the proposal, which in itself is an extraordinary arrogance. Everyone knew that back pay owed to the army was criminally high, 26 weeks lacking to the infantry, almost double that to the cavalry, maybe in all a stonking 3 million quid. Hollis marched on. The self-denying ordinance seems to have lapsed since the start of the war, meaning that several army officers had been elected as MPs. So, Hollis now carried a motion that no member of the Commons should hold a military commission. Cromwell, Ireton and others would have to go, again, all independents. At the same time, a petition spookily dropped into the Commons inbox. The London Common Council were demanding the army be disbanded and that control of the London trained bands be taken away from Fairfax as general of all armed forces and handed back to London. So, Cromwell arrived back from illness into a parliament seething with all of this. He wrote to warn Fairfax of the situation. "There want not in all places men who have so much malice against the army as besots them. Never were the spirits of men more embittered than now." Bulstrode Whitlock watched aghast at all this, absolutely astonished at the turnaround. "Those who were so lately in their highest esteem and respect as freers of their country from servitude and oppression are now, by the same people, looked upon as sectaries and oppressors themselves." Hollis and co. weren't finished yet. They then passed an ordinance that no commander under Fairfax should be a higher rank than colonel, and confirmed also that everyone in the army must swear to the Covenant. This was a clear attack on independents, who would no way want to sign such a thing, and a personal attack on Cromwell to boot as Lieutenant General. But more was to follow. But to explain, I need first to nip across the Irish Sea. So, with the defeat of the New Scots in Ulster, the triumph of Rinuccini and the clerical party in the Confederate Association, Ormond was simply left without options, facing a resurgent Confederate Association which had abandoned the cessation or any ideas of a negotiated peace. In desperation in February 1647, Ormond threw in his hand. Recognising that Charles was now powerless to help him, he passed control of Dublin to Parliament. A new governor was duly appointed, Viscount Lisle, and Ormond packed his bags and came back to Blighty for a while, leaving behind a task which he had done his level best to fulfil. He would soon end up in France with the Royalist resistance. Anyway, the point about all of that is that Parliament is now categorically in charge of meeting the Irish Confederate Rebellion rather than Charles or whatever. And in early March, they had a declaration passed that they would recruit an army of 4,000 men for Ireland. At the same time, they voted to maintain the Army of Northern England under Colonel Poyntz, undisbanded, intact from all the changes. This was an extraordinary decision from a military standpoint to maintain the poorly disciplined old army of the north while disbanding the cream of the army in the new model. There is obviously method in this apparent military madness. Hollis and co. were building an army just in case the new model needed persuading. They hoped that the London-trained bands, now back under the London Common Council control, and Poyntz's northern army, could be relied on to support Parliament and the Presbyterians to face down any resistance by the new model at the end of a musket, an insurance policy should the new model need pushing over the edge. And indeed there was another source of military muscle available to them. As we heard last time, Edward Massey's old-style Western Association army had been disbanded already. What this meant was that unemployed soldiers and officers, reformados as they were called, had flooded into London. They were all over the place. Most of them were Presbyterians also. Most of them could be handy in a scrap. Despite Fairfax and Cromwell's attempts to conciliate and comply with Parliament's orders, there is no doubt that the Presbyterians saw them as the enemy too. So, Hollis was building an army. And also, recruiting an army for Ireland was not simply to repress rebellion. It served a higher purpose, because recruitment would surely split and weaken the new model. As MP William Strode ominously declared, "Sir Thomas Fairfax will be deceived, for part of his army will join with us. We will destroy them all." Well, there's a thing. This is all going rather nicely so far for Hollis and co, don't you think? On the 21st of March, 1647, a delegation sent by the Derby House Committee arrived at the army headquarters at Saffron Walden, led by one William, the ex-conqueror Waller. They were there to discuss the formation of the new Irish army from the shards of the soon-to-be-broken-up new model. They walked into the beginnings of a storm. Expecting to meet Fairfax and maybe a couple of aides, they instead walked into a room of 44 senior officers who were waiting for them. "Thanks for coming, William," said the officers. "Good to hear about Ireland. We do have some questions, though, and until we have answers, no one's going anywhere." There were four questions about the Irish army, plus the big one. "What are you going to do about our back pay?" "Thanks for your feedback," said William, and on the 22nd of March, back home he went. Essentially, Fairfax was well aware of what had been going on. He was well aware of the rising worry and fury of the soldiers, and here was the start of the fight back. He had called all these officers to show his solidarity and sympathy with their concerns and get Parliament to behave properly. He knew that masses of petitions were circulating among the regiments of the army, breeding like rabbits they were. The officers had gathered them all up, removed all the chaff, and produced a petition with five requests. Firstly, they needed an indemnity over any acts carried out during the war. It wasn't necessarily atrocities or stuff they were like that they were worried about. But just for example, loads and loads of horses had been requisitioned through the war. They were worried that a load of angry horse owners would come after them for payment. That sort of thing. And more serious stuff, of course. Secondly, payment of all arrears of pay, obs. Thirdly, a promise of no forced conscription for service abroad. I should say, Ireland, for example. Then fair compensation for maimed soldiers and their families, and regular pay until disbandment. So 2 points to make about that. One, totally reasonable, hardly needed saying, surely. Secondly, there is nothing political about it at all. These are all straightforward army employment grievances, you might say. The levellers don't seem to be influential in the army at all. Yet. However, the levellers did choose this very moment to publish their second major petition, the so-called large petition, waged between the reasonably substantial petition and the frankly titchy and puny petition. Now, the large petition, my friends, was about as political as you are going to get. It was addressed to the House of Commons, because obviously that was where all true authority lay, and that was actually the thing that got everyone excited. The Commons is sovereign, it said, not the King, not the Lords. The Commons. A number of other exhortations follow. Complete religious toleration. Abolition of tithes, therefore. Radical legal reform. All justice to be conducted in English. None of this ancient Italian mumbo-jumbo stuff, for example. It condemned the prison system, which, to be fair, could do with a bit of condemning and will still be condemnable when Charles Dickens picks it up a few hundred years later. Now, these things hit the Presbyterians in Parliament. At the same time, someone brought a copy of the large petition in, and then one of the commissioners sort of found the petition of the officers and soldiers of the army lying around accidentally on purpose at Saffron Walden, and he read it out in the Commons on the 27th of March to boot. Well, said Hollis, well, I could squash a grape. Or worse. Frankly, I think it's fair to say that faced with both these outrages, Hollis rather lost it. Edmund Ludlow, the radical army officer and regicide, wrote in his diary later that Hollis sat on the benches in the Commons and drew up a resolution on his knee. As he wrote on his knee, Ardenzel might have heard the babbling of a brook down by his feet. When he presented what he'd written to the Commons and they passed said resolution by vote, he had unknowingly stepped over that babbling brook. That babbling brook was the Rubicon. It was only a short resolution. I counted it, 256 words. There are three things about this Commons resolution. One, it stated the Commons' high dislike of the army petition, which is kind of confrontational. It said it wasn't going to bother to answer it and they should stop right away, which is kind of confrontational to the point of tyranny, actually, because petitioning was a fundamental English right. After all, what else would disgusted of Tunbridge Wells do on a Sunday afternoon if it wasn't? And thirdly, it said, if they don't stop all this, they would be considered enemies to the state. Now that is incendiary and deeply insulting to the people who had fought for Hollis's right to be sitting in Parliament at all. Enemies of the state? That was to be constantly repeated and those words thrown back in Hollis's face by the army. Enemies of the state. We, who shed our blood for the state. This little resolution has gone down in history as the Declaration of Dislike, and in John Morrill's words, it showed Hollis's ability to be simultaneously resolute and reckless, courageous and crass. A royalist commentator actually giggled that maybe, possibly, perhaps, inflaming 20,000 heavily armed bloke might not be the best tactics. Henry Ireton, army colonel, MP, and whose signature was on the original army petition, was livid. He and Hollis ended up yelling at each other in the Commons and they left the House intending fully to have a duel, but then came back having called it off later. Which does sound a little bit like the sort of thing that went on at school, remember? Right you, bike sheds, 5 minutes, that sort of thing. Anyway, it put Fairfax and Cromwell in a tricky position. The instinct of both of them, actually, was to conciliate. This was Parliament, after all, for whose rights they had put their lives on the line. Fairfax had obediently had the declaration read out to the regiments. Cromwell put his hand on his heart in Parliament and swore by Almighty God that the new model army would disband when told. Which turned out to be a lousy prediction. Though other interpretations are available, of course, there is a line of argument that Cromwell was perfectly capable of a spot of hypocrisy and dissembling. Or, as Richard Overton the Leveller put it rather later, "You shall scarce speak to Cromwell about anything, but he will lay his hand on his breast, elevate his eyes and call God to record. He will weep, howl and repent, even while he doth smite you under the fifth rib." It is a good quote, Overton knew how to use words. For what it's worth, Antonia Fraser thinks this time he was simply reading the crystal ball badly. Anywho, after Fairfax's command to the army to shush, for 2 weeks all did seem quiet. So that's good then. Phew-wee. Hollis and co. put their heads together and proceeded with the next stage then, divide and conquer. They reckoned they could spike the army guns by splitting them up. By pressing ahead with the Irish recruitment, they'd split them into smaller groups. So, recruitment for Ireland became a double tool of repression, one for Ireland, one for the new model. On the 15th of April, a delegation came to Saffron Walden to enlist men for Ireland. This time, Fairfax called out captains and lieutenants of every troop, so the four commissioners were then faced with over 200 officers. It didn't go well. They had nothing to say in response to that army petition. The young Yorkshireman, Colonel John Lambert, demanded on behalf of them that they would know who would command. The answer was Philip Skippon and Edward Massey. Everything got rowdy very quickly. The four commissioners left with fleas buzzing in one ear and the sound of the soldiers' yells of "Fairfax and Cromwell and we all go! Fairfax and Cromwell and we all go!" ringing in the other. Which basically meant that without the leaders they trusted, no one was going anywhere, whatever Parliament said. Parliament still kept going, but by the end of April, recruitment for Ireland was a paltry 115 officers and 1,000 soldiers, which wouldn't blow the skin off a rice pudding, let alone defeat the Confederate Association. The new model was now in a foment and taking action. The soldiers were driven by indignation at their treatment and fear that if they were disbanded, they would end up being prosecuted as enemies of the state. They must stick together or die. Soldiers began to plan and organise, spreading across the army from cavalry then to infantry regiments. They began to choose representatives. And now the word agitator enters our language. It isn't quite what it means now. Think instead of agent. The officers didn't try to stop this at all. In fact, their men often sought them out and were encouraged and advised. A standard structure emerged. Two agitators per regiment. The agitators all began to meet together in a sort of informal council. Now the name John Lilburn began to be heard. More of the regiments were becoming politicised. But as yet, it's not widespread, but it is a sign of things to come. But there is no sign at all of republicanism, by the way. In fact, a sense of pretty positive goodwill towards the king reigns, even a desire to carry him to London, where he'd put everything right for them. Parliament pressed on regardless of all this. It gave command of the London-trained bands officially to the Common Council, and they then purged any independent officers from it. And then, on the 27th of April, it committed its cardinal folly, the absolute cherry on the top of the lardy cake of idiocy. It made a decision about the pay to be given to the army when it disbanded, which was to be soon, in June. They would get 6 weeks' pay. 6 weeks against 40-plus weeks owed. Seriously, if Hollis and co. wanted a military revolt, they were going about it in the perfect way. They could run seminars on how to make enemies and blow your credibility. The following day, three men from the Council of Agitators, Edward Sexby, William Allen and one other, presented Fairfax a petition from the 8 cavalry regiments, and 2 days later they took it to the Commons and read it out at the bar. They stood there being angrily questioned and roasted about their demands for pay and indemnity by the assembled outraged house. They stood as firm as a regiment of pike facing a cavalry charge. They yielded not one inch. Which was even more irritating. Didn't they know who they were talking to? Skippon, Cromwell, Ireton and Fleetwood were then sent as commissioners by Parliament to try and calm things down. All four were respected military commanders, and they were therefore respectfully received. But while they were there, petitions were being prepared by every regiment, and a group of 7 officers took down those petitions, boiled them all into a set of 11 common grievances. It was an impressive document. Officers like Colonel Lambert praised the way that officers and men had worked together. Any political content was removed from the grievances so as not to raise the heat. All the 11 grievances were about purely army matters, arrears of pay, indemnity, that sort of thing. On the 21st of May 1647, the commissioners returned to Parliament. Cromwell himself read out these grievances. He repeated his pledge that the army would disband, but warned that the temper of the soldiers was passing beyond their ability to control now. Skippon also reported on the deep sense of suffering in the army. They all warned that the declaration of dislike had offended the honour of the soldiers to the very quick. Now, this was another Rubicon moment. If Hollis and Co. had thought this through now, if they had behaved at last with decency, maybe this could have been settled amicably. Withdraw the declaration of dislike, up the payment of arrears, address those grievances. Others could see it. The French ambassador commented that if the government was overthrown, it would be because the Presbyterians failed to act generously. But for those Presbyterians, the loss of face would have been way too much to bear now. Things had gone way too far. And anyway, they felt confident they could deal with anything. What with the trained bands, Reformados, Poyntz's Northern Army, they had 20,000 men under their command. And they'd already split away the soldiers who wanted to go to Ireland. And of them, about 100 officers and 400 soldiers had been incorporated into the London militia. They started chats with both Scottish and French ambassadors about bringing Scottish soldiers back over the border if necessary. So you know what? Bring it on! You and whose army? Dacia! At the same time, the Lords announced that they had received a lovely letter from the King. So charming! And they had, actually. Charles played a canny game at this point, as he could do. He also realised that the departure of the Scots had been to his advantage and to the Presbyterian party, and knew he had a great opportunity to widen the division in the ranks of his people. So, he restated his response to the Newcastle propositions, but using a much more positive tone, hinting at toleration for independence, if not really giving much away. Hollis and Co. were delighted. Such a lovely letter. Did you read it? Parliament formally agreed that this was indeed a basis for further negotiation. The Lords suggested inviting the King to come to Oatlands House, a mere 15 miles from London. And then, 2 days later, the Commons approved an order to dissolve the new model army. They would cease to be between the 1st and 15th of June. The sense of crisis was palpable. The new model would be dissolved and its soldiers made powerless. A secret deal between Parliament and the King appeared imminent, an agreement made without the independence, and the King seemingly to be moved from Holdenby to Oatlands, out of the army's control and ready to be reinstated as King. There was a spreading reaction. Colonel Rainsborough's regiment in Plymouth had gone AWOL and effectively mutinied, moving to Oxford to take control of the artillery there. Fairfax had received a petition signed by 16 regiments calling on him to announce a general rendezvous of the army in defiance of the order to disband, so that they could all discuss a response. He called an enlarged council of war of about 100 officers in Bury St Edmunds on the 29th of May. He asked them two questions. Had they done enough to address the grievances of the soldiers? The answer from the officers was no. The second question was whether they were in favour of a general rendezvous in defiance of the order to disband, and the answer was yes. So here it is. Decision time for Fairfax. If he called that rendezvous, it would be in direct challenge to the authority of the Parliament he was pledged to support. If he refused and allowed the demobilisation to go ahead as Parliament was ordering, he was deserting his army, the army to which he had given his life and honour. He could resign and walk away, but that would leave the army leaderless. He could not know it, but a junior officer, In fact, an officer of the lowliest rank in the cavalry, a cornet, was already planning to take action. We will hear then about what Fairfax decides next time. We will also learn that Charles does indeed have a sense of humour and a very nice line in dry wit. And we will learn if the Presbyterian junto will succeed in its attempt to seize control of England's future. So there's lots to look forward to. Thank you all for listening. It is lovely of you. Do let me know what you think of everything. Good luck, and thanks for all the fish.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.